I met Jerry because David, I was looking for where to go, and basically David Anton, I mean, it's just gossip. David Anton sent me to Jerry in New York. So when I started living in New York again, after those years of graduate school, that's when I met Jerry. I never knew Jerry in San Diego.
Yes.
No,
so
Jerry has a different recollection.
Through that context, having come to New York and reading those things, being quite amazed at the cut-ups, of course, the use of found text, which I was very interested in as a poet, and also the interesting use of I,
mm-hmm.
whether in poetry or fiction, was,
yeah.
was quite striking, this creation of the black tarantula.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I started to read the work, and I've been reading it since. I also actually saw you at Bernadette Mayer's workshop probably that same year when you came to talk.
Yeah, but Bernadette and I were close.
Project.
Yeah.
Just to link it up with people who come here. That
right.
Poets, that, because you really do come to some degree out
yeah.
of several worlds. But
come out of several
poetry,
worlds, yeah.
Poetry world, too.
Yeah. Yeah, long time ago. Yeah.
So, that is my introduction.
Yeah.
I remember once actually a performance that you did at St. Mark's in which you were scheduled to read and you had the microphone. You just let everybody speak in the microphone, but you put the microphones out of the audience.
Oh, yeah. I used to do all sorts of things. Yeah. We had sometimes we traded performances with each other. Yeah, we did a lot of funny things. Not to centralize the eye.
Now that we have our group together. Now, Kathy has come here, some of you have read her work, of course, and seen her poem last night, to have it to be in conversation.
Right.
Rather than to give a talk.
Well, I want to find out where all of you are at. Now, I can do various things. Do you mind if I just ask what people want to do, or is it...
I think that's, you can do whatever you like. That's a perfectly good thing to do.
Okay. I can talk about my work. You can direct me how to talk about my work. I mean, there's been lots and lots of years of it. And as Charles says, I come out of many different worlds, so I can talk about it in various ways. I can talk about what I'm doing now. I can read you. For those of you who don't know my work, I can read a section, and then we can talk, a very recent work, and then we can talk. You can tell me what you do. We can simply talk about issues. Why don't you tell me a bit? I know it's sort of hard because we don't, you know each other somewhat, but you don't know me and I don't know you, so it's a bit hard to start talking, but why don't you give me some idea of how you, at least in the beginning, you want this to go? Oh, please. Come on. Well, I'll ask you questions. How many of you, now don't be shy about this because I'm a very peculiar writer and, you know, as there's no reason that you should, but how many of you sort of know my work, or maybe I should read a bit of work? So are there enough people that, I mean, should I read a bit, or can we just start talking about it right now?
Can you read something that you're doing now?
Okay, and then we can start from there. Oh, is that cool with everyone? Yay, I got responses. All right, I didn't bring along, I just brought along this because it was easy, and I'm tired from the read. I'm still very jet-lagged, and I haven't had breakfast yet, so this isn't going to be, great. All right, now what should I do? I could read you two pages. This is just fun. I used to, in the early days, as Charles said, do my own publishing, right? And what I did is I had this idea of doing a Dickens novel where I'd do, different serial novel, right? And I'd send out chapters every month because, Dickens didn't do that, but then he had lots of money behind him.
I just have a question about that. That's not TVRT Press, or was that something?
Yes, TVRT Press was the press that picked it up.
Okay, because that's
right?
What I first did.
Yeah, I first did it myself, and then I schlock it around in the green garbage bag to all the bookstores, and just too many people wanted it, you know, after 3 years of doing it. I was I talked into everyone to doing the printers, doing it for free, it was just too much, right? So then this press called TVRT came along and said, we'll republish one of them. There were three books. It was The Childlike Life of the Black Tarantula, I Dreamt I Was a Nymphomaniac Imagining, which was sort of a joke because Eleanor Anton, the Antons were my close friends, and Eleanor Anton at that time, and Eleanor Anton had just done a piece called I Dreamt I Was a Ballerina. So I did this little, second installment called I Dreamt I Was a Nymphomaniac Imagining. And then there was The Adult Life of Toulouse-Lautrec. And of course, The Adult Life of Toulouse-Lautrec was by Toulouse-Lautrec. And I'd change names every day, you know, it was like I was living in San Francisco, and it was just when this group, for all of you who know this, the Coquettes became the Angels of Light, and all my friends were changing their names every day, too, so it was fine. I first started off as Rip-Off Red Girl Detective, but that is unpublishable, that thing. But anyway, it's sitting there. Actually, it's sitting at Duke University at the moment, but what the hell? I mean, it's just rotten away in my house. So, I don't know where we were. You always have to, my students, like, know that my mind does not go in any linear fashion whatsoever. So what you must do is now and then bring me back to wherever I was, because I've gone off somewhere. Anyway, what were we talking about? We were talking about, oh, my doing those little books. So then TVRT came along and said, we want to republish this one book, The Childlike Life of the Black Tarantula. So that's how that started. And they were connected to Saul LeWitt somehow. They were like these two guys who were some, one of them, Ted Castle, is one of the main art critics in New York, especially for the sort of group around conceptual art. And I was really very fast got into that area of the world. I wasn't quite accepted among poets in those days. I think it was more lifestyle than anything else. Because I was, first of all, what I was doing was weird. I wasn't writing. I didn't really care about doing nice writing. I was really a Burroughs freak. And, you know, and in lifestyle, I had been disowned by my family and gotten very sick. So I was working in the sex show to earn money. And that was difficult for people around me in the poetry world. So it was much more comfortable for me in the conceptual art world. And a lot of the ways I was writing came out of what people were doing in conceptual art. I was really, really influenced by that, by work of Dan Graham, Joseph Kosuth, people like that. So it was kind of, you know, the TVRT press people, especially Ted, were from the art world. And I very quickly came back to New York and very much got involved in the art world in those old days. So it was another world I came out of. So that they had a connection to Saul LeWitt, and Saul at that point was the main backer behind Printed Matter, and then, you know, there were other people that came in. So I was really, my first publisher, besides TVRT, was Printed Matter. So that was that trajectory. Well, you know, everyone closes doors on certain people. We're human. It's not like you close doors on people. It's just, you know, people hang out with some people and not with others. And it was kind of the hippie years, you know. And because I was working the sex show, I wasn't a hippie. I was kind of like real proto-punk, you know. And my view of the world was very dark for most people. See, I started doing this journal when I was working in the sex show. Because, you know, I'd do a show and then I'd sit in, I think, Tad's Steakhouse. I got real good at sitting in Tad's Steakhouse and writing. And, you know, there I was on 42nd Street, right? And so I do kind of a journal, and then I go through all the experiments in Burroughs' books, especially The Third Mind, and I'd apply it to this kind of, you know, autobiographical work. I mean, this is really early years, and a book called Politics came out of this. So it really wasn't fitting into hippie culture at all, right? I mean, my view of sexuality, for one, was not very rosy, right? But neither were any feminists going to, you know, take up the work in those days either, because, you know, there's a lot of stuff, you know, it wasn't Hearts and Flowers time, you know, even between the women. So, I mean, I think a lot of the feeling, I remember Ted Berrigan saying, oh, that weird sex freak, referring to me. So, I mean, it wasn't animosity or anything, but I wasn't... No, he didn't mean positive. Well, Ted and I were friends. But there was, you know, some of the early Andrew Warhol people, Joe D'Alessandro was working around the corner at the Metropole. That was the big sex show place. And so I was kind of hanging out on the just on the edge of the Warhol scene. And they didn't quite mesh. You know, but some people were doing, they were hanging out both places, but there was a sensibility that was funny. I mean, that wasn't meshing quite. So it's not like closed doors. It was more like I didn't feel comfortable. And, you know, I also felt very much, it took me a long time. I didn't really feel comfortable in the world until punk came along. You know, and then suddenly when punk came along, it's like someone like me felt comfortable because everyone else was just like an insect against the wall. I mean, that's what I felt like. I felt like an insect against the wall. I mean, at least in the art world, it's just everyone was older than me, so I just shut my mouth and I was like the mascot they could take everywhere. so there was a place to be a freak. So that made me comfortable. But punk made me real. I mean, that's the first time I felt like I ever talked to anybody.
Is that for writing the journal you were just talking about writing? Is that where your current style started?
My current style, my style. I don't have a style. It's sort of the process started, not in those days, but started with a book called The Childlike Life of the Black Tarantula, and that's where I first began looking at the word I and what the word I could be about, what it was about, you know, how it functioned. I was very curious of how certain areas of language functioned in the world, you know, and I started off with how does this word function, you know, this is way post-theory, I mean post-theory, pre-theory, yeah, time's not linear, what the fuck, but... but this is what, you know, but that's where it started off. You know, there was a sense of it in the earlier work, as in this politics, but it was, I was still working through Burroughs, you know, and I could do a trace of where stuff was from, and God knows so much is in Burroughs, and I've never understood why a lot of postmodern theorists don't go right to Burroughs, why someone like Jameson says Bill Gibson's the only writer around. I mean, I love Gibson's work, but, you know, so they excuse me, please. You know, go back and read Wart William. But anyway, that's another rant and rave. It started with that business about identity. Really went through identity by the end of that series, the Toulouse Tarantula Nymphomaniac, where I decided that identity was a false problem. You know, I'd say, what I'd do is I'd set up problems and I'd just write according to the problems, and the problems would dictate the kind of writing. So I wasn't terribly interested in style as style. I was interested in style as dictated by whatever problem I was setting up in those days. I mean, I thought of it as a kind of scientific work.
What's another kind of problem that you would set up?
That's the one I did in those days. And then by the end of it, I got very uninterested in identity because it seemed that identity was something that was made. I mean, I'm saying this very simplistically, and it was pretty simple back in those days. But, you know, what quickly came in was the problem of language, that I was working in a medium that wasn't transparent or even translucent. You know, so, and I had to consider both language and memory. So that made the thing more complicated. And I did a stupid work called Kathy Goes to Haiti, just because I wanted to write a porn book to make money. And so I wrote a kind of straight book, and it took me about 6 pages to get bored out of my mind, so I started playing, like, games, like Raymond Kano games, you know, little mathematical things, and, you know, just to amuse myself, but it's a really dumb book. But the book, I did a book called Blood and Guts in High School. Really, I thought, in my very punked-out mind in those days, this was just the beginning of punk 76, 75, 76, I thought this was going to be a commercial book. I don't think I had a clue what a commercial book was, but I was so poverty-stricken, I was just anything. But what interested me in that book was the work, was the end of the book, the stuff I, at that time, was the stuff I did about Jean Genet, where I used a lot of Genet's texts, and I sort of started using appropriate, I had always worked with other texts, but now I no longer had, like, I'm going to try to investigate identity. Now, I didn't have a problem prior to the appropriation of the text. I was just appropriating the text, and that fascinated me. And I realized what I really wanted to do was just use other texts. I mean, this wasn't new to me. The first poetry reading I ever gave in my life, I repeated the lyrics of rock and roll songs. So it must have, you know, whatever. Someone said, what you do as a kid is what you do all your life. Well, there's some truth in that. But anyway, so I got really interested in repetition, which came out of a lot of the memory stuff. I was working with a philosopher named Bergson on the early memory, not the famous Henri Bergson, another one who was teaching in one of those Midwest colleges. I met some students of his. Anyway, I'm going off again. I've got to stop it. So I got really interested in repetition, especially in repetition of texts, and repetition also of texts that are not just verbal. What happens if you repeat a visual text verbally, things like that. And that became Great Expectations. So that was another kind of, if you like, experiment. If you're asking how, you know, what were other problems. So, you know, identity, I became uninterested, though I've always played around with the word I. I mean, I've never used the word I to mean, you know, to you know, point at, to signify me. Or I've never shared what this is. or, you know, it's getting, we're getting on a huge problem here, so, I'm trying to skirt it very badly. It is just, you know, I'm talking from memory of 20 years now, and probably everything I'm saying is wrong, but anyway, so I got interested in this business about appropriation. Sherry Levine's work was a real sort of, like, key for me at this time, and I was involved with some of the Metro people who were with Metro Pictures at that time, Richard Prince. I never knew Sherry Levine, but certainly Richard and I were good friends. David Sally and I were friends at that time, that group of artists. So that work came out of, you know, a lot being influenced by their work. And then in 76, I met a guy named, this just give you an idea of the kind of things were going on. I met a guy named Sylvain Letranger, and he introduced me to the work of Michel Foucault and Deleuze and Guattari. And there, you know, they kind of explained to me a lot of things I was doing I didn't understand. I didn't understand why I was gender slipping, or very gender indefinite, if even had a sense of what gender was. Why I was slipping in many ways, why my narratives were decentralized. That is the easiest way to say it, so excuse the jargon and just interrupt me if I'm saying something that's... And reading their work gave me a sense of why I was doing what I was doing and also a way of going onwards. So, you know, I did from 76 onwards, so I can answer more questions about them. But that was the beginning of the work. I mean, that gives you, I think, an idea from, like, 71 to 76. Anti-Oedipus. Remember, we're dealing a long time ago. But yeah, Anti-Oedipus was just, you know, basically was my Bible for a number of years. And, you know, I just started rereading it this year, and I thought, because the new novel, I just finished a novel a week ago, and Antonin Artaud is one of the main characters, or in the beginning is one of the main characters. And so I went back and reread Anti-Oedipus, and I thought, wow, this thing holds up like I never thought it would. You know, it's still sort of like really amazing to me politically. What's in this stuff. Any more questions on that one, or is that answer?
Well, I was just reading, I've just been reading different repetition Deleuze. Mm-hmm. Thinking about your work and going into it. Not that I can formulate it in
You know, I don't know a lot of Deleuze outside of his work with Guattari. And I've been reading mainly the feminists, Irigaray, I never say her name properly, and Six Yu to some extent. I teach Three Steps in the Ladder of Writing, which is why I adore that text to teach it. It's very ungrammatical. And I used to like early Kristeva, Powers of Horror especially. The later Kristeva and the return to the mother and all that business doesn't move me terribly. I mean, I just don't find it useful. And I, you know, lately I really question her version of jouissance. I thought we were talking about theorists. the work of Teresa de Laurentiis, I like. I'm sorry. I have a very black sense of humor. Bad girl. But the work of Teresa de Laurentiis, right now, I'm just reading Irigaray all the time, and Judith Butler on Irigaray. I have to do a piece on gender, so I'm going to run that very first section of This Sex, which is not one, the Alice in Wonderland business. I want to run Judith Butler's reading on that, and then go back to the actual Alice in Wonderland and, you know, find gender in the two things. So that's what I'm reading at the moment, is that kind of stuff. And I like De Laurentiis' redo of Freud a lot. You know, and re-looking at the imaginary through that stuff. Anyway, gobbledygook, get me started on this and I'll blab away.
Well, I'm kind of interested in that issue, like your sort of relationship to feminism.
Well, which feminism?
I mean, I guess that's part of the question, like, where are you?
I mean, in the early days, you know, you could say what one was. Now I think there's so many feminisms that, I mean, just to say, is one a feminist? I would be shocked if any woman in the world said she wasn't a feminist, except insofar as she thought feminism equaled separatism. That I'm always really curious, my students, you know, when I talk about feminism, sometimes they go, oh my God. And I mean, I'm looking at every Pierce Dyke in the world, and they're going, me, a feminist? And I said, well, excuse me, please. And they said, well, we're not ugly and we don't wear khakis. So I say, no, you're not ugly and you don't wear khakis. So, you know, there's feminism and feminism. I never know what people are going to mean by it, right? I think not only as women, as people, all of our lives have been changed by feminism. You know, it's like, to my mind, one of the main revolutions we've seen, and it's a really nonviolent revolution. It's something that's changed all our lives. You know, so I, you know, you say, do you relate to it? How could anyone not relate to it? We live in culture.
Yeah, I guess I'm just curious, like, where you locate yourself in
that.
Which is sort of what you're addressing.
I'm not brilliant at locating myself. I can tell you what I'm working on, and I work with a lot of the writing that came out of France. For some reason, I have this real, you know, whatever, draw towards French writing, and which includes French theory, especially for the last 3 years with the work of Irigaray. Right. I mean, I have trouble with Alain Sixyou's work, though some of it I adore. You know, there are a number of theorists in this country I work with, and this isn't just feminists. I'm very close to people called Arthur and Mary Louise Croker, for those of you. They're very, very close friends, Stephen Fall. I mean, these are my closest friends. I work with C Theory, which is the Croker's magazine that's on the web. I work with a lot of cyber people. You know, it's not just feminism, but that's... You know, I'm greatly, great admirer of Donna Haraway, though it's a little out of what I understand. I'm kind of a science dope, but, you know, there's a woman named Sadie Plant I'm going to meet, who I'm very anxious to meet, who did a book on the Situationists. She's English, and she works with a guy. Anyway, I can go through names, but this is, you know, I guess if I have to see myself, I even see myself in terms of work. You know, who am I working with? It doesn't mean I have to know them, but... You know, where am I working? What am I reading? And I don't think we live all one life. I think we all live lots of lives. You know, and at the moment, you know, this is what I'm doing. And I've done other things. You know, I've worked with poets. I've worked with, you know, changes all the time.
What's your relationship with the situation?
Worship. Worship. Adoration.
Is there also a connection with the American section of the situation?
I know some of them, but I've never worked directly. I've met a few of the ones in San Francisco, but I've never worked directly with them. In France, I was close to some people for a while, who Faton Cayenne, and for a while I know Fai, Mitsu Kansa. The left-wing splinter of Tel Quel when it becomes Change, and I knew some of those people for a while, and they, you know, Guattari was very close with the Situationists, and they were working with the Autonomia, and I just saw Bifo last year, the Italian man who was head of Radio Alice, so, you know, a few connections. Read? Yes? More questions prior to reading? Okay, maybe after the reading we can start talking about issues and content and, I mean, unless you want, I mean, I'm willing to blab about my autobiography endlessly, but it went fun for me to find out what you think, too. Anyway, this is a chapter, it's half a chapter from the book I just finished. The book's called Pussy King of the Pirates. And there are these two girls, O and Ange, and then there are all the pirate girls. And in the middle section, I tell the stories of some of the pirate girls. I tell the story of Pussy, who becomes Pussy King of the Pirates. That's what I read last night, just the beginning and end. And I tell the story of ostracism, and I tell the story of Antigone. And this is just the first half of ostracism's story. And I just grabbed this because it was easiest to grab. This is like... Since I've been with big publishers, I can never do anything about graphics or design or anything. So I did this with friends just so I'd have presents to give away to people. And I got to work with, the cover doesn't look the way I wanted it to, but the inside is really great. And I've just never gotten to, like, have any control over design or pictures since I've been with big publishers, so it's a real treat to go back and do, you know, a little chapbook that no one's going to make any money off of, and so it's, this is like my present to myself this year. You know, and we found a publisher who's willing to do it, and they'll make a little money, and so that's what this little thing's about. And this great woman, Diane DeMassa, did most of the drawings. She does a comic book called Hothead Paisan, so if you know her work. So let's see, what should I read to you of this? I can read, like, either three pages, because we mainly want to talk about issues, right? So I should read something that, what do I, how much do you want to hear? Be, like, real, like, give me idea of minutes. Remember, I'm dumb. How long is this thing last?
Well, let's say we should probably think of ending about 1:30, although we can actually go almost to 2, but depending on...
1:30? I'm going to read you a tiny section. Okay, let me read you a little section. I'll run you through the beginning of this so you get... All right, I'll just read the very beginning so you get an idea. This is ostracisms talking. I don't have a father. I thought that the man who married my mother was my father. As soon as she married him, she died. I was 8 years old when I found out that he wasn't my real father. I continued to call him Dad, this man who was kind to me, gentle and stupid. My real father is the taker away of dreams. I was brought up in a lonely, primitive place. Until I left that portion of the world, I didn't have any friends, except for a dog so old he looked dead, and dead people. The dead people lived in a cemetery. This church, remaining roofless, which sat like a dead dog in its middle, was the only building neighboring on our house. The family who owned the cemetery and its immediate environs were now dead. Their name had been Karnstein. All right, so it starts off like almost children's book style, right? By the way, for all of you who are big horror film freaks like me, you'll recognize Karnstein, of course, which is, this is ripped off of a short story by Sheridan Le Fanu called Camille. However, it's not ripped off of that. It's ripped off of, there's a wonderful group of films that come out of England called the Hammer Horror Films. And the Hammer Horror did a trilogy based on this one short story by Sheridan Le Fanu, which are the crappiest B films, most wonderful things. And like, for, they're vampire films. And there's one where there's this beautiful woman vampire. They're all at girls' schools, and I've got a thing for girls' schools, right? And there's this one where there's this beautiful vampire, and of course the guy, you know, the handsome guy who comes there, who's like a poet or something, falls in love with her, right? But she's kind of in love with him, so she doesn't want him to suck his blood out, right? So she doesn't want to have normal sex with him, because he'll become a vampire then or die or whatever happens when he gets sucked by a vampire. So instead, he goes down on her. And at the moment that he's going down on her, it all becomes psychedelic in the background, and it starts going, strange love. It's fabulous. Anyway, greatly influenced by the Hammer Horror, I ripped him off. So the beginning you just heard is, the beginning is rip-off of Hammer Horror Camille. Right. Okay, then it starts getting into dream time, and what I've started to do in the last novel I wrote, which is called My Mother Demonology, is I've started to let my, and this is new for me, it's not appropriation, is I've started to let my narratives, I've started to work narratively, but what I've done is made, let my narratives be guided, be absolutely directed by my dreams. That is, I'll set up a narrative, either an appropriated text or, well, if it's autobiography, I regard it as an appropriated text. I'm either appropriating my own life or I'm appropriating another text. It's not much difference, it's just text, right? But, you know, it all has the same reality value, that is virtual reality. But what I'm letting things now happen is that as I dream the night that I'm writing whatever that text is, I let the narrative go the way of what I've dreamt. So I end up in very peculiar places. I mean, it's a very funny thing to do because it's a funny giving up of control. And one reason I'm working with dreams this way is I really got into it reading. I started reading this book when I was reading My Mother Demonology. Well, let me tell you the problem, and then I can tell you why I was reading the book. I got to a place in my writing where I couldn't find a site to write from. I felt very oppressed by my past history as a writer, what people expected of me, what people thought of my writing. I had often used the place of sex as a place that seemed a site to start at, and that was no longer possible. partly because of what's happened with AIDS, partly, I mean, I'm sure we all live in this world where sex is no longer this free place, you know, and I don't have to explain this, you know, partly of the sexism of the world, you know, et cetera, et cetera. So I was looking for a site to write from that I didn't feel, that I just need this freedom. I don't know how to explain this word freedom, but I'll let that stay as a problem for the moment. And I started working with dreams, and it was right back to the surrealists at the moment when I started working with them that surprised me, the Breton, right? But then it became something else, just by chance, and I greatly trust chance. You know, I like working with that wonderful space between chance, that kind of time or chaos, and what we think is determined, knowable time, linear time. I was reading a book called Ecstasies by Carlo Ginzburg, who used to be a professor at UCLA. I don't know if he's still there. He was at the Getty Institute where I met him. And the book was purportedly about the Black Sabbath. What the book really is about, it's a marvelous book, is it has two structures. One is a negative content structure. It's about the structure of prejudice, and it goes from prejudice about lepers through anti-Semitism to sexism, especially prejudice about women being witches and where that started in the 12th and 13th centuries. The other side of the book is about the pagan tradition, right, which isn't just a female tradition, but I started reading this book, I got an idea of an alternate history being somewhat, but not absolutely not totally a woman's history that had to do with witchcraft, which I'd never been interested in before. So I started finding, you know, reading everything I could on witchcraft. And, you know, San Francisco's a wonderful place to live if you get interested in this stuff because you have witches all around you. So I started doing actual work with people on dreaming. Right, so that was what was lying. And what I was looking for was, I've always had this thing about language, feeling outside language, feeling, you know, having a real difficulty with language. I think partly being female, partly for other reasons, because this isn't just, you know, I can talk about this in terms of, the way Irigaray would put it would be the phallocentricism of the world. But I can also talk about it as someone called Karl Kraus back at, you know, before the turn of the century talked about how language is being manipulated. You know, it's how, and, you know, I'm sure you all know Walter Benjamin's thing about breath and trying to bring language back to breath, that in the beginning was the word and the word was God, which you also found in the beginning of the Rig Vedas. So, you know, there's all this stuff that came into, and the easiest way of saying it, rather than saying all this stuff that came into it, is I was trying to find what language, rather than having to deal with this language I've always felt outside of, how could I access language that was there? What languages were there to access? That says, for instance, very simply, when you dream, you don't make it up. You know, it's just there. There's not anything you can do about it. And that fascinates me, coming to a language that is there. Right, and there are other languages that way. I was asked to do a piece on bodybuilding, and I started blocking. I never block. I write too much, actually. So I was very fascinated. Why was I blocking? And I got very curious about languages, you know, that when athletes are involved in intense athletic activity, I don't think it's just bodybuilders. I happen to know about bodybuilding the best, so that's easiest for me. They go through a very intense language, but they can't say what that language is once they've stopped the activity. And I got very curious, what does that language look like? What is it? Right, the same thing with sexual language. What is the language that actually goes through, wherever language goes through, when you're going through things like orgasms, or orgasm if you're a guy or whatever? I mean, I don't know what it is to be a guy, so. But I got very interested in these, you know, languages to access, right? So, you know, this immediately goes into dream, right? And I've been letting dreams run the narrative for this reason. All right, now you're going to hear where it goes next. I'll read you this little section. All right, what happens in, just to give you the, you know, surface narrative so you're not lost, is ostracism's father and ostracism low in the countryside. Lo and behold, young girls are dying everywhere, right? So he sends her off to a school so that she'll be safe. You know, she won't be one of these young girls who's dying in the deserted countryside. Also, there's this sense that, you know, she's getting to an age where it might not be so cool for her to live alone with him. Right, that's just kind of left. So she goes off to this girls' school, and what I'm going to read you is just the first, she starts keeping a diary when she first gets to this girls' school. Yeah, it's a girls' school because Hammer Horror, they're always girls' schools, and they flit around in togas and whatnot. Anyway, this is the first pages of her diary when she's in girls' school. Okay, there's this little stupid little thing that goes, school, come in. School is a dairy because all headmistresses are cows.
I'm sorry. Come in. I just wanted to drop them off for class. Sorry.
That's okay.
Now that I'm in school, I'm never again going to be alone. I used to hate girls. I remember. Girls are stupid. Girls always lie. What I meant was that I was from a different race than all of them. Because the same blood wasn't in me that was in them. When I was with them, I was awkward. I wasn't right. There are only girls in this school, so now I'm thinking about girls all the time. I can't know what I'm dreaming because my mind's so occupied with wanting to fuck this girl. No date. The word fuck means something, but I don't know what it means in this school. Today, I masturbated. Here's what I wrote while I was masturbating. Whenever I look at her, I look through her eyes and then walk into her. Even though I'm in this school, which means I'm going to have to leave school because I'm going to graduate, I'm never going to be without her. Now, because I'm walking inside her, I own her. I live between her fingernails and the skin that's underneath them. As yet, there aren't any pirates. Again, no date. And again while masturbating. Pirate sex began on the date when the liquids began to gush forward, as if when equals because. At the same time, my pirate penis shot out of my body. As it thrust out of my body, it moved into my body. I don't remember where. My penis walked into my body each time that it did, by tapping like a male monkey on a section of the female skin, by then punching through that skin to all which was lying below, to skin upon skin. Sometimes plastic containers holding liquids such as water and piss sat between the skins. Pirates, you see, are hot to puncture through. After they've done this, they need to piss or shoot into another person. This is why this, my body, is the beginning of pirate sex. All of us girls have been dead for so long, but we're not going to be anymore. After not having sex for years, the pirates came to a land where they could again have sex. Of course, they were girls. They tramped, trampled down roses, blustered, bragged their way, stomped, then limped into this territory. Some of them even pissed in their pants. They were remembering their childhoods. Pirate number one. I'm looking for a place to lay down my cock. Overhearing this foul sentence, a long-standing pirate named Kiss of Rot, who was aware that cocks lay themselves down only in recipients, instructed the young criminal that a receptacle had to look into her eyes before she could shoot into that receptacle. Now a receptacle is looking into my eyes so I can look into her eyes. When I do, I walk right into the center of her brains. Because I'm here, I can shoot. In the midst of my emission, she opens again. Each opening opens up. Each opening series touches another opening series without entering its territory. There's no confusion anywhere. When I see all this order, my eyeballs rotate 180 degrees in their sockets. I'm gazing into a world in which sight is impossible. Today, no one can find little girls anymore. They had all gone down to wherever they went when they returned home. The more of them that disappeared, the more the flowers shot out of the earth. Whenever a colorful plant emerges from one of the holes in the dirt, out of which cunt juice is always welling, a young girl could again be seen. So that's the beginning of the diary section that immediately becomes narrative and goes into how she meets this girl named Pussycat. And then, you know, whatever the story begins. But the reason I read you this is I wanted to hear all, most of what you heard is language that wasn't stuff I made up at all. It's language that I accessed through sexual stuff. So it was stuff that was just, you know, I mean, I made the writing, it was changed to as little as you change just when you're writing down a dream. But I became very, what goes through when you're going through sex. So that was some of it. And that, as the whole book goes on, Pussy King of the Pirates, that language starts taking over the narrative. So it becomes, Pussy King of the Pirates is a girl's version of Treasure Island. I mean, it's just Treasure Island with everyone's a girl. And it's the search for buried treasure. And the way the buried treasure is found is partly through dreaming, partly through the sexual language, which isn't made up like someone will write about sex. I wasn't writing about sex. I was accessing that language. So that's the work now.
Were you writing? I remember when I saw you in Portland, I thought you said you wrote as you were having sex.
Yeah.
So did you do that?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's what I meant by accessing sexual language. You know, the pen was here, the hand was here. did that? Any questions? What should I blab on?
First thing that came to mind for this talk was the graphic quality of the sex.
Hmm.
I mean, and especially once they realized that it wasn't meant to be pornography, you know, there were.
I don't think that's pornography.
No.
Yeah.
I'm saying, in other words, if they were familiar with that kind of language, that might be one place where they were. And I wondered whether, I mean, it obviously has a jolting effect for some readers when they.
Oh, yeah.
Is it something that.
More than that.
Would want to imagine, you know, continues to jolt readers? Is it something that, you know...
I think that has to do so much with the context of society. I mean, you know, who knows? Because, it's funny, you know... with different periods. I mean, now we're in Gingrich territory, so who knows what things are going to look like. You know, it's very hard to tell. You know, I mean, does my stuff jolt people? Oh, it does more than that. I've received death threats. You know, I did a teaching gig at the University of Idaho in September, and there was gun trouble. You know, I mean, there was real trouble, and I got out of town just in time. And it wasn't just nasty comments either. You know, who knows, right? I mean, am I writing in order to do that to people? No. I have very little interest in shocking anyone. I couldn't care less. You know, I've never had any idea I'd be read by the masses. Do I have ideas, however, in my head, not that I'm doing it, but that we together are all working towards changing things? Oh, yes, I do. You know, and there's a difference.
Well, I guess I was thinking of a strategy, like, you know, for example, reappropriating language. Reorient the way in which it's perceived,
yeah.
So that it can't be.
Yeah, everyone I know says dyke. Yeah.
All right. Is that? I guess I'm wondering because one of the ways I understood that language to work was, you know, if one continues to read instead of, you know, being sort of put off by it, that it's a sort of way of reappropriating.
Well, as far as, you know, parts of women's bodies, cunt, pussy, etc. You know, I have every pussy joke going in this new book. It's just ridiculous. I mean, I can say, I'll say this specifically, and then maybe that we can elaborate from, you know, because I'm replying too specifically to your question, but sometimes maybe, you know, like saying cherry to say red, maybe it helps to be specific sometimes. I always, the way I see it is that prior to whatever, 20th century, something like that, women economically basically had to be either wives or whores. Or, you know, somehow in the sex trade in order to make a living. It was very unusual for a woman to make a living, you know, working, right? And And therefore, they were economically dependent on the function of their sexual organs, one way or the other, either by having babies or by supplying pleasure to men. And therefore, when there have been many rounds of feminism, but when the round of feminism, say, came about, say, we're talking about T. Grace Atkinson, or T. Grace, is that her name? God, I forget now. So many years ago. Anyway, the stuff that happened in the 60s, right? Dare I say Gloria Steinem, I don't. There was a lot, one of the movements into women trying to say, all right, now I have power, was to want to deny the heritage, you know, this really ghastly heritage, where any sexual desire, delight, feeling, you know, immediately had to do with this economic necessity and, you know, the history of having to survive based on your sexual organs, which is a very ugly history, you know? So there's an attempt, in a way, to want to deny it because it's very hard to have any power if you've got to, you know, keep sitting in that history, right? So there was a whole movement. I mean, this is kind of a dumb analysis, but there was a whole movement in feminism of women not wanting. And what happened in this movement of women, you know, which makes a lot of sense, of women not wanting to bring out their sexualities, of not wanting to be sexual, which is what comes down to, is it interiorized a lot of the stuff that was coming from this more sexist part of society, right? And, you know, women operate in sexism as much as men do. We're all living in a patriarchal society. And that, you know, was that you're relegated to the sexual realm, but you must not, it's a double bind, you must not say the words. You must not be able to talk about it. That is, you know, if I was back in the 19th century, I would, unless I was like a spin, you know, one of those rare spinsters or rare women who wore men's clothes on the whole, I would have to be either a wife or in the sex trade. And I, on top of that, would not be allowed to talk about it. The words of my body are dirty words. I cannot say masturbate. I cannot say cunt. I cannot say menstruate, especially. What is the filthiest thing in the world? A used Kotex. Right? That's the most common thing to women. Right? So there's a way in which this, when we use this language, we're suddenly allowed to talk about our histories and our lives. You see, we weren't allowed to talk about it because we couldn't even have the language. And I'm sure it operates that way in many cases. You know, I'm just being specific now. I mean, that's how I see it.
You're talking about the already there-ness of dreams and being interested in languages that are kind of static, but also easily accessible and...
Static.
Or just
slang.
Like, when you say already there, like you're talking about Freud's dream language, it's already there.
I'm not talking about Freud. I am talking about dreams.
Oh, that's what I was thinking when you were talking about that. Anyway, like I think what's most radical about what you're doing is pluralizing sexuality, saying sexualities instead of sexuality. Sorry, my voice isn't very good, but there seems something scarier. It's not some problem I've always had in writing and equating women writing or my writing as a woman with sexuality, which seems somehow the only way to go, in a way.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm always negotiating shock mm-hmm. and kind of like basicness, like to say something that, like I'm negotiating shock, sexual shock sometimes, but not necessarily with like everyday boring banal language
mm-hmm.
that comes through, which is also to me very important. And
mm-hmm.
And I get stymied and stuttering and I get blocked by the fact that when I take a language of shock, which I think is politically important,
mm-hmm.
it becomes so banal and kind of, it becomes this pornography that serves the same purpose pornography serves sometimes.
Mm-hmm. Where are you writing from? I mean, do you feel shocked or do you feel other people are shocked?
No, I always think about it in terms of the audience of shock.
That might be a problem. Because it's hard, you're writing then from a place that's not from, I hate to sound like an essentialist as far as identity goes, but I think sometimes if you're thinking of what the audience wants, how the audience going to, you're making up something, right? Like if you start thinking about, oh, I have to do this for the future, you make up the future, but the fact is, you know, probably Heraclitus is more than right in this one, that by the time we're in the future, that's the present and we're somebody else. It's very hard to write that outside, I think, especially about something like sexuality.
I mean, I radically believe that there is no self, particularly for women, that women are masquerade and have to take on certain
But there must be something in you where you locate pleasure.
No,
yes.
I don't believe in any kind of language about, no.
But you do locate pleasure.
Locate
pleasure. Pleasure in yourself, or it's pleasure somewhere.
No, I don't.
You don't?
No.
Ah. We need to have a long conversation.
No, I don't. Never. Don't
right.
In fact, I think that's the main problem with all sorts of, like, I think your kinds of appropriations are positive and good, and I agree with them, but of course there's a history of radical, like, awful, horrendous kinds of appropriations in this world, you know?
Oh, absolutely.
And,
well, I'm not saying appropriation is good or bad. I'm saying it works on appropriation.
Yeah. But I think that kind of appropriation, the bad kind of appropriation, is all predicated upon that very sense of inward sense of self that I don't agree with. And so, like, to me, to have a location...
Now, are you talking about inward sense of self in terms of individualism?
Yeah,
like an enclosed self?
That's one kind.
Right. What about just feel, you know, when you, like, feel pleasure? I mean, does that have to do with self for you?
It feels like somebody else is feeling pleasure.
Right. Huh. What about other... oh, sorry, I'm really fascinated. when you write, where do you write from?
I write to somebody. Letters.
Right.
And I've been trying to appropriate my own letters and something.
I have a student who does that, a really interesting writer named Pippin. She's been appropriating her mother's letters. Quite fascinating. Do you get into being other people?
I force myself to, yeah.
You force yourself to, but it's not.
I am not. I'm different people all the time.
Right.
And so, like, I try and exaggerate that when I write more.
Is there pleasure in that?
There's a pleasure in a certain kind of tone that you can get. I get pleasure in appropriating language, but that's where I get pleasure. I think,
right.
Yeah, there is.
Yeah.
I'd say it's mine for a moment or two.
Well, someone feels it that you can recognize as, you know.
Close to home.
Yeah.
I guess, yeah. Yeah.
Wow.
I don't know. I mean, how do you feel about it? Like, do you ever feel like you have to be, like, it might be almost more shocking to say the most obvious thing? Like, in a way, like, just to talk about what's in front of people's faces.
A lot of... You know, I don't think a lot about what people are going to think of what I write, except in terms of clarity. I mean, my main interest is that...
You know, I
do... On the whole, I don't when I'm doing it, and I distrust it when I'm thinking politically when I'm doing it, but the politics kind of whelms out. Basically, I'm a kid in a room who's getting off on what I'm writing. I mean, basically, I like writing when I think... No one could be that stupid. And I go, hey, I can. Or, you know, this is really like, ooh. I mean, that's my main, I really get off on writing. But it's that sense of, like, no one's telling me what to do at the moment. You know, I'm free. I mean, freedom is like a big thing for me when I write.
So I don't see language as so free. I feel like it's totally overdetermined.
Well, that's why I'm looking for these other languages, right? Because when it gets overdetermined is when I want to run the other way. I mean, I can't write people letters because they feel so overdetermined. I've never written a grant in my life.
Yeah.
You know, I can't bear it. I just like, I can't do it. My best feeling about that is I once went to visit a friend of mine, Genesis Peorage, and he lived in a town called Montecito, which is partly a Hell's Angel town. And he lived on a real funny hill, which I couldn't drive my bike up. But so I stopped at the Pink Elephant, which was his bar at the bottom of the hill. And I go into this bar, and it's a Hell's Angels bar. They're retired Hell's Angels, the fattest guys you've ever seen in your life. And the guy behind the bar, so I walk in, and he goes, hey, nice tats, girl. So I knew I was fine. So the guy behind the bar is filling out, like, an SSI form or some form. I couldn't figure it wasn't SSI. It was one of those forms, right? And they asked him about his mother. So he said, oh, they want to know, what's my relation to my mother? So another fat old slob goes, you fuck her. He said, yeah, right. I fucked my mother. I was going, this is so cool, I don't believe it. And I thought, that's how I'd like to fill out a form to the government. So that's what I have a feeling, you know. I had a feeling, and let me remember, almost say it. It was more about where are we, how, it felt like, It was a political thing. It felt like everything's, if I say everything's shit right now, felt like we're going towards a fairly centralized world economically, and therefore in terms of power. I mean, it's like as if left and right no longer makes sense, and there's nothing to do about it. You know, that's it. It's, you know, so granted that we're living in, and I don't just mean, I'm not a Marxist, so I don't mean, you know, I don't think that the ground is economic, but, you know, there are various grounds, and one is economic, sort of shifting Marxist. Granted that things aren't going to change, right? I mean, the economic power is going to get more and more centralized. That's it. Nothing's going to change anything. How can I and my friends live in this world and be happy? Right? And I think I set the problem up, it set itself up, because I didn't, I don't, like, have an idea of books till I'm in the middle of writing them. But I think the problem in that book set itself up dialectically. Like, here's the Oedipal, you know, I picked kind of the Oedipal myth, you know, why? You know, sorry, I'm being ironic about myself. I sort of picked, you know, like, as the beginning, all right, you know, this is we're in the Oedipally defined society. You know, so I used Sade and Freud as my main appropriated texts. Then I picked what I thought would be the antithesis, which would, you know, other, you know, non-white, whatever. I picked Jean Genet and a lot of, I was fascinated with the early first part of the revolution in Haiti, that first revolution where Macandal was the leader. So I used that as a text. And then the synthesis, because at the end of that, in my book, the CIA comes in, and they actually did. I mean, that was all factual, the stuff I took. But to me, it was also, I don't know what the word, I don't like the word symbolic, but it signified that that's what always is. You don't run away. You know, I went through the hippie stuff. You know, I've sort of, my generation came in right at the tail end of hippies. And it always seemed to me you don't run away from things. You don't leave the world. You live in whatever world you're living in, and you deal with that world. So, you know, which comes back to the original problem. So that, you know, where the book would ended would be that thing. Well, okay, you know, we're not going anywhere else. How do we deal with this world now and find some way of, you know, having decent lives? So, yeah, that's what was very much. So that Hannah Arendt quotation that starts the beginning of the last section about being powerless, you know, which is partly the reason for that title, Empire, the Senseless. Yeah, that was definitely the problem for me. Memory. It's something about being power, you know, those who are powerless. It's from Men in Hard Times, which is like one of my favorite books.
We have, it's probably a copy of the box right next to you.
Oh. Well, it's the end, it's the third here. But the blazing will to live anew, and the struggle of these people to realize themselves in the world of modern times, whose sin is to have been made without them. That is, the times were made without the people. The people are powerless. They didn't have control over their own society. Her syntax is a little funny in that one. Yeah, so that's...
Could you say something about your relation?
No, it's okay. I'll go next.
About your relationship towards popular culture, because popular culture in a very subversive way, very
right.
Much like William Burroughs in his novel, for example, science fiction.
Yeah. Well, William was my first model, that's for sure. I don't think I distinguish between popular and non-popular culture. I think I've got a funny thing about elitism, but I don't think I make. I guess I think. One of my, you know, there are many models for how the mind works, and one of my grossest is that my mind's a garbage can, and culture is everything, you know, all the garbage that's gone into it, and it's all useful. I think of things being useful or not useful, and, you know, whatever, Hammer horror films are as useful as Hegel. You know, it's just all there to be used. And, you know, there's some parts, aspects of high culture I like. There's some aspects of popular culture I like. I don't have an attitude about one or the other. You know, it might come from my upbringing, because I had a kind of double-class upbringing. I came from very high class and very low class. But I don't even have a theory about the whole thing, you know, other than it's just useful.
No, I was speaking of the use you make of popular imagery.
I make the same use of high culture as I make of popular culture. It's all, I'll appropriate any text I can get my hands on. You know, I'll just, anything that comes within little grasping hands gets, you know, some things are hard to appropriate. William Burroughs is very hard to appropriate. I've tried a few times. You can't appropriate William. He's untouchable. You get William. Whatever you do, you know, it's fucking William. There are a few things I can't appropriate. They drive me nuts.
You think Nike appropriated William Burroughs?
I think William appropriated Nike. Oh, yeah. I think William doesn't give a god. Come on, William says, I think someone at Nike has a good sense of humor. William saying that technology's in service of the body. Now we know what he's referring to, but do the mass of Americans know?
I think what the mass of Americans look at that commercial and say that William Burroughs is saying that Nike is making a better built shoe than its competitor Reebok. There are two different reasons for buying a tennis shoe. One is for cachet. William Burroughs does not have the cachet of Michael Jordan, so there has to be another reason. The other reason is its functionality. But
William couldn't even.
I know he couldn't care, but I think that's what that's happening.
Yeah, but I mean, to see an 80-year-old guy hobbling around, is it exactly, you know, an idea of the functionality of a tennis shoe? I mean, if I hear William saying technology is in service of the body, I think junk, right? I mean, that's the most technology William knows. Yeah, that's true, too. I think it's a riot, you know, and what did William get for it? $250,000? My man, more power to the guys. Poverty stinks, you know. If William can get some money now, you know, good for William. Yeah, he deserves it. He's the greatest writer in America. That's my little opinion.
Well, because junk is the same problem, but, I mean, people were complaining, well, the Jordan is making all this money to sell, you know, basketball shoes that sell for $100 a set to kids who are on junk, you know, who really can't afford it and you know, pursue, let's say, problematic means of getting that money. I understand where Burroughs is coming from.
We are all being used. I get used by Grove Press. I get used by, if I went through how I've been used, I mean, I don't think you can make money in this country and not be used. I don't know, you know, what to call it. Let's call it post-capitalism for the moment. But, you know, we live in a very unpleasant economic system where we get eaten so we can make money. And we use ourselves. Anyone who's in the public has an image. And anyone who has an image or has to deal publicly is in a use situation. And it's partly using, you know, that deadpan, dead fish thing of William the Old, that's a use, you know. That's inhuman. That's ugly. Right? People do that. He's got to protect himself. Right? I mean, that's the thing. We all have to figure out how to live in a society which is not comfortable for human life, in which the imagination is relegated to the dustbin, you know, and the imagination is all that is like the soul and dreams and emotions and everything else. And we've got to figure out how to live in this society, you know, where money's God and not even money. You know, look, money isn't anything. You know, that's Baudrillard's black hole. We're used.
It seems to me like an empire of senseless if we're backing away from, well, that you're proposing a kind of anarchistic society.
You know, I'm not a theorist, so I don't know what would be the answer, but I guess I'm kind of an anarchist, yeah. I mean, I don't go to anarchist meetings or anything.
The rules of the road section at the end, I mean, that seems to overturn, you know, who is it, Divine?
The biker stuff, yeah.
She picks up the rules of the road and tries to...
Oh, yeah, I had to get my motorcycle license, so I had to read all these fucking rules and the book was due, so the two came together. I think that was just, you know, like I had this romance. You know, I'm real good at, like, going to where my romances are. I write partly out of fascination, you know, out of horror. Like, if something really, like, has a lot of energy, I'll go to it and look at it. And writing's a way of looking. And I think, you know, I had this romance about bikers. And then I went there to some of the stuff, and I went, oh, this is pretty creepy. You know, so another romance in the old dustbin, but I still love bikes, so that didn't stop nothing, but I'm kind of, like, obsessed about bikes, but, you know, it's just, like, another way of overthrowing the, you know, social romance, you know, another icon presented by the society. I mean, actually, bikers have nothing to do with that stuff anyway, but that was something I found in a motorcycle magazine, that story, you know, that really ugly story. So, you know, and there are all these kind of, like, whatever, in the verbiage of the culture, there are all these beliefs sitting there, you know, these, and we take them in, you know, we eat them up.
Yeah, just think, when you, if you don't believe in sort of any sort of rule, and that's sort of what the biker culture is, then you can say, well, I'm not being used because I'm not in anyone's employ.
Well, that's what I'm saying. That's the mediated version of the biker culture, right? That's the biker is the Hell's Angel who came out of the, where did they come out of, the Navy or something? No, they were Air Force boys, you know, and they're just going to the hell with everybody and we're just going to hit the road. Actually, bikers aren't like that. I mean, first of all, anyone who drives a bike and doesn't drive really carefully is dead in about 3 minutes. They're such goddamn dangerous machines that you have to be, like, super, super on to drive them. Right? So if you actually lived like that, you would. I mean, the Hell's Angels on the holes don't drive bikes. They're too fucked up. It's true. They all have big cars. Yeah, people who drive bikes now in the hole, as the, you know, bike industry knows, are basically executives who want to take a weekend, you know, ride and show off their Harley clothes. And then just people like me who, you know, like bikes. But no, you couldn't be like that and drive a bike. So that's you know, that's just a wonderful example of how the social model, or, you know, I'm saying this incorrectly, I wish I was a theorist. The model as presented in society is simply doesn't correspond to the actuality.
Yeah, well, I guess what I'm saying is that if in the first part of the book you explode the idea of the patriarchy, then isn't there the proposition, well, you know, here's anarchism, or here's another sort of social order without a hierarchy, and then that turns off to be sort of equally untenable.
Yeah, well, I don't think that, you see, what I think doesn't work is dualism. I don't think thinking this or that, this, not this, therefore that, which is not this, is going to work anymore. I don't think it's as simple as we're going to find any way out by doing positive-negative moves. You know, this, therefore, you know, either-or moves. I think what we're going to have to do is really explode our whole system of thinking, which is the dualistic thinking. And this is where I take Irigaray really seriously, where she talks about propinquity rather than dealing in dualism. That is, it's not that sexism is on men. It's that the whole structure, that closure called male, female, male and or female is fucked, I'll just say it very bluntly, fucked us up, right? And the only way we're going to get out of it is not by indulging in that kind of thinking anymore, but really changing the order of thought. I mean, if you're going to have to overthrow, I'll say it very simply, you have to overthrow Descartes, right? I mean, it seems to be, you know, I agree with her that. As far as that goes. What lies after that, I don't know. It's partly why I'm accessing these languages. You know, I'm hoping to find something that looks other than Descartesian thought, which is the interest in the body, that most changeable thing, that most poison, you know, substance. Does that make sense to you?
Do your partners know before you start the sex that you're going to be writing?
I didn't do this with partners.
Oh, this is without partners?
Yeah.
You write?
But if I ever did it with a partner, which I don't know, maybe I could do someone, maybe I could persuade. Now, what am I supposed to do? Not tell them? I mean, you know. No, I mean, come on, man, let's have fun. We're going to do this kinky thing.
There's a joke about, you know, Clarissa, that she's scribbling the letters as she's being assaulted.
made of that one.
And still have time for the assault.
Well, you know, I mean, haven't you ever, like, you know, made a love affair worse so you could write about it?
Well, perhaps that's a good moment to just take.
We fine? We're way over time, aren't
we're not
we?
Over time.